It's another night of basketball in Peach Palace. LSU trying to stay abreast the Tennessee Volunteers. They need to beat the Gators tonight to do so, setting up what should be and could be one of those moments in Tiger Town. We'll get the very latest on LSU baseball. They're 4-0. What's been the storyline to date? And there's a new Ryder Cup captain. Is it the good old boys club all over again? I'm tired of losing to the Europeans. All these stories and more today, Wednesday, February 20th, 2019.
Awaits the 3-2. It's a line drive right at Broussard. He leaps into the air, pulls it down, and two are gone here in the top of the seventh inning. Left-hander ready to go. Cabrera goes opposite field, down the line and left. This one going to drop in fair territory just in front of the track. Taking it off the wall is Ray, but Cabrera with a one-out stand-up double. Little bloop into shallow left field. Going back is Gross. Can't get to it. He was playing it on the infield grass. And Mathis put it where they ain't. Coming in to score, DiGiacomo gives the Tigers a 6-5 lead here in the bottom of the eighth inning.
And that's exactly how it would end up. A strong performance by a trio of LSU veteran relievers. A couple of some key hits by newcomers. A pair of bunts. And LSU got it done 6-5 over southeastern Louisiana on a damp and dreary evening in Alec Box. The good news is, one, they won. Two, they got the game in. And that's all she wrote. With that, we say good afternoon and welcome. My main man, CD, back in the master control suite in the 237 Roof Studios on the campus of Delta Media, KLWB 1037 The Game. Yours truly, I'm Jordy, here, Studio 1A. Great to be with you. Thanks so much for joining us on this miserable Wednesday. Miserable weather-wise, but far from it miserable if you're an LSU Tiger fan, because everything's going smoothly to date. Baseball, still number one in the country, right? And LSU basketball with another opportunity tonight as the 13th-ranked team in the country at 11-1 in league play, trying to get another win under their belt with the Florida Gators. Tip at 6 o'clock tonight, meaning the pregame show will be at 5:30, and it's all right here on your source for LSU sports in Acadiana, right here on 103.7 The Game. Tennessee was a winner last night over Vanderbilt. Didn't look very good doing so, but all that matters is you chalk up wins, and they did. Now they're 12-1. Kentucky went on the road to Missouri, had a big lead, squandered a little bit. They didn't look particularly great, but they win. They're now 11-2. LSU sitting there right in the middle. They'll make up the difference in the game tonight. A win over Florida would put the Tigers at 12-1 as well, setting up a Saturday showdown with the Tennessee Volunteers for first place in the SEC. To do so, LSU's going to have to take care of the basketball. They're going to have to, they're one of the better scoring teams in the league. They're going up against the best defensive team in the league, in the Florida Gators. We'll get a scouting report coming up, as we do on the day of every LSU game. My good friend John Brady, the former LSU coach, color analyst on the LSU Sports Radio Network, will join us for his views on this ball game. And it's a simple thing. It's LSU with their scoring ability at 83 points a game, second best in the league. Florida with one of the stingiest, if not stingiest, defenses in the league, giving up only 68 points. Where LSU has the advantage is on the boards. Florida's not very tall, not very tall at all. LSU's got two bigs towering over the Gators. LSU averaging 38 rebounds a game. Florida dead last in the league at 23. Can LSU continue to pound the glass? Can they continue to execute? So one of the better shooting teams in the league, LSU going against the worst shooting team in the SEC in Florida. So this is a typical, if the game gets into the 70s, LSU wins. If the game's in the 60s, look out. So we'll get John Brady's views on it. Michael Huguenin, Hump Day with Huguenin, will join us from The Athletic. Alabama's filled out their coaching staff. They've got some retreads. What's the best rivalry in all of sports? You've got Duke, North Carolina in hoops tonight at Cameron Indoor Stadium. Only seats about 9,000. They give the very best seats in the house to the student body, one of the rare entities that does so. And on the secondary market, if you want to get in the game tonight, it's going to cost you $2,500. How about that? $2,500. It's the Zion Williamson factor. It's the only time he'll take on the Tar Heels at Cameron Indoor, because he's bye-bye after this one. Michael Huguenin will join us. Brody Miller in hour number two after Hot Topics, NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. Everybody's raving about the new catcher on the block, Brock Mathis. And Palminteri saw his season flash away from him right between his eyes when one of his key players got hit. We'll explain that story. And Steve Stricker, little golf note. You know I love the Ryder Cup. I'm all about that. I'm aggravated that the United States just can't seem to get it right, and the Europeans have dominated them of late, including this past year in Paris. It just wasn't even close. Steve Stricker named the new Ryder Cup captain. We'll deal with that. We'll deal with the cheapskate, Matt Kuchar, and how far will they drive the ball in Mexico? Alex Myers, our golf analyst from Golf Digest, will join us to discuss that. We are presented each and every day by DC's Little Capital Exxon, I-10 at the Henderson Cecilia exit in Brobridge. Everything you need for your travels, whether you're going 5, 50, or 500 miles, they've got it. And that true soul food deli tucked away in the corner, the best cheeseburger you've ever tasted, and so much more. It's my go-to stop. Why don't you make it your go-to stop? Just try it once. You'll be back to DC's Little Capital Exxon, I-10 at the Henderson Cecilia exit in Brobridge. LSU basketball, center stage. John Brady joins us next. The keys to the victory and more here on Acadiana's number one sports station, 103.7 The Game, 1037thegame.com. This is the Jordy Helpert Show.
Play cards with a guy whose last name is a state. Don't spit into the wind. And always get your sports talk from the Jordy Hultberg Show. Live and local. 103.7 The Game.
And we welcome you back. It's another golden opportunity for the LSU basketball Tigers, currently 11-1 in the SEC. They've won a ton of games in a variety of fashions. They've won on the road, undefeated there. Now they get to hold serve on the home court as the Florida Gators come to town. A pretty darn hot Florida Gator team that is kind of a North Pole, South Pole of what LSU does and what Florida does. John Brady has studied them. He'll be on the call of the game tonight on 103.7 The Game. He and Chris Blair and John is kind enough to join us on game day for his thoughts on it. Man, this is what a fun year it's been, huh, John? Gee whiz.
It's been a great year, and it's going to be a fun week. You got Florida, and then you got Tennessee coming in, so it's a good week. Been a lot of fun. Been fun to watch this team grow and develop, yeah. Mature, individual players get better. Winning, as you said in the opening there, in a variety of ways. I mean, we've had different players make big plays at different times. And the flexibility and the variety that he has offensively has really been a plus for this team.
No doubt. People keep talking about, and I don't know how much stock I put into it, but trap games. Are you a believer in that? I mean, everybody says, oh, be careful, Florida trap game, because everybody's looking ahead to Tennessee. I just don't buy that.
Well, Florida's a good basketball team. Yeah. I don't know where they have disrespect for Florida. Florida's won two in a row. They're leading the league in points allowed a game. They're they make 8.5 threes a game, so they're good when they shoot it. But they give up 63, we score 83. So, yeah. You know, it's going to be one of those games, as you alluded to. Whoever does what they do for a longer period of time will probably win the game tonight.
Rebounding seems to be the biggest strength that LSU has over Florida. They're not very tall, and they're the bottom of the barrel in the league in rebounding, and LSU's right there at the top. I would imagine let's get it off the glass like they've been doing all year long.
Well, every time LSU, Jordy, gets an offensive rebound, and I really made the point of that early in the year that, mm-hmm. you know, this LSU team can offensive rebound it. Man, yeah. I think that Williams and Darius Days really impressed me from day one. And now everybody else has seemed to got in it. But if you don't keep LSU off the offensive glass, you know, Jordy, if you shoot 40% from the floor, which is not a great stat, but if you go rebound the ball every third time you miss it and put it back in, that brings it up to about 47%,
yes.
you know, because if you go, if you shoot three times and go 0 for 3, but you rebound the fourth one and stick it back in and the ball hadn't transitioned back the other way, it's
right.
like shooting 100%.
Yeah.
So, you know, LSU covers themselves sometimes with a poor field goal stat by getting to the free throw line and getting offensive rebounds.
John Brady, kind enough to join us here. How impressed were you? I mean, look, I don't know how it was for you when you coached at LSU and had to go into Tuscaloosa. I remember playing in Tuscaloosa. Man, that was one of the more difficult places for us to play. Florida went in there, beat them by 18.
Well, you know, and then I see where Alabama got beat by Texas A&M last night as well. So maybe,
yes.
something may be going on with that team that we don't know about. But, you know, anytime you go into Tuscaloosa and win by 18 and hold them to a low field goal percentage and a lower amount of points than they're used to scoring on their home floor, you've got a nice defensive basketball team. And I think I think LSU is going to try to push the ball tonight, be aggressive offensively, try to get to the free throw line as much as they can, and then try to win that field goal stat or at least battle it to where it's close This LSU team, Joe, they're going to score 75 points. Now, I don't know if Florida can get 75.
I think that's
going to be the question as we watch this game tonight.
Kind of surprised me, Florida being a defensive team that they are, and they struggle offensively. They're the worst shooting team in the league. They like to press you, a 1-2-2, and that kind of seems to me that gets the tempo going up, and that wouldn't be conducive there. I'm not doubting Mike White. I think he's a really good coach, but – please press LSU with Waters Mays, please.
Well, I don't think it's a trapping, gambling type of pressure as much as it is a contained sort of pressure to make you laterally throw the ball back and forth and get time off the shot clock and control the game in that way and make it more of a possession game, a lower possession game than LSU would like it to be.
Makes perfect sense. What was your biggest takeaway against a Georgia team that I thought played very, very well? They've got a couple of players that are pretty darn good. What was your biggest takeaway from that win after a big win against Kentucky just prior to it?
Well, I think that was the trap game, to win at Rupp Arena and then go on the road 2 days or 3 days later with the euphoria that beating Kentucky in Rupp Arena creates, and then going into a situation at Georgia where everybody expects you to beat them now because of what you just did. Now, that's a trap to me, the players having a letdown. But that game, Georgia started the second half. They were 10 for 12 from the field, and LSU was only down 4. And I just thought to myself, we're fine. Chris Blair asked me what I thought. I said, well, I think we're fine. Georgia's playing the best it can. We're only down 4. Let's just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you finish the game, they went back to who they were because, Jordy, for those teams, the game is too long. They finished the game 4-for-17. They came back to who they were, shooting 42% from the floor, and LSU keeps scoring and was able to win the game down the stretch.
I mean, they didn't. LSU didn't turn the ball over in the second half. That's I don't see
Not
that
one.
Very often.
I don't ever see it.
Seriously.
That's unheard of. That means you know, most teams will turn it over 6 or 8 times and a half or something along that line, and then for LSU to not turn it over, they're getting more shots to pass. They're either getting to the free throw line or getting shots to goal. So, you know, that was a tremendous stat for LSU to be able to have, and I don't think anybody needs to take that for granted, just how efficient offensively that is when you don't have one turnover the second half.
I've got to tell you, I got to admit, John Brady kind enough to join us here, LSU, Florida, 6 o'clock tip in Peach Palace. I wasn't all that high on Naz Reid, but I'm starting to see a player. I'm not doubting his effort, his energy, but I'm starting to see a player that's starting to get it. And, boy, to me, he's been the player that's improved the most on this LSU basketball team, despite coming in with the most hype.
Well, he probably was in the most difficult situation as well, you know, with expectation level being pretty high for a guy that never bounced it or shot it at the collegiate level. So he may have started a little bit slow, but I think it's tougher for sometimes a big to meet expectation than a guard who really has the ball all the time, and you can readily see his quickness and his athletic ability because he's handling it all the time. But for Naz, I agree with you. This guy, I've watched him now. He has never balked on anything Coach Wade has tried to challenge him or make him do or coach him in any way. He's never resisted that at all. He's gotten better and better, and he's one of the critical players that needs to play well now for LSU, I think, to have a chance to win in big games. The second half against Georgia, he was scoreless. And I thought Coach Wade did a really great thing. He came out the second half, ran a play to get it to Naz on the post. He got involved early. He got fouled. He made 2 free throws. He finished the half with 13 points with not scoring in the first half. And I think Coach Wade got him going by getting him involved early on. And I thought that was really good for Will to do, and it's really good to get Naz involved as well.
Yeah, you got to keep those bigs happy. No question about that. Did you ever have a – who was – yeah, you know, you got to keep those guys. They're so moody. I mean, you got to keep the bigs happy or they'll pout, go home to mama. You know how that is.
Yeah, complain to the girlfriend or something.
Yeah,
you know?
It's awful. You never had any worries with guards, man. We were always tough. Anyway, who was the best trash talker you ever had? Because it apparently seems to me that Javonte Smart's pretty good at this stuff. You ever have a good one?
Yeah, Torres Bright was like that, and Lamont Rowland was like that. They they would get the opponent going pretty good. So, you know, and I don't, you know, a lot of guys hit it well. You know, I think Taz and Mitchell talked a little bit. And I'm sure Big Baby laid out a few things along the way as well. But I think the real good ones sometimes don't get caught. They do it, but they don't get stuck sometimes. But you know, and Will Wade used that as a motivational thing for his team. You know, a lot of coaches would get mad at the guy and jerk him out, and you know, and Will understands his team, and he used it as a positive thing and turned it into a situation to get his team playing better. And he credited that, and that's what happened.
I had a guy I played with, Greg Cook. He would trash talk, but he trash talked his own teammates during the game. I mean, I'm like, Greg, we're on the same team. What are you doing? Well, you better start playing better. I'm like, man.
Hey, when he was in resting mode, he looked like he was something. I tell you, I was scared of him just to walk by him.
The Cookie Man, may you rest in peace. All right, yeah, you always come up with keys to wins. You talked about it. LSU, if they do what they do better, longer, they'll win it. What do they do better than Florida?
Well, they scored better than Florida, and Florida gives up a lot less points than LSU allows. So I'm going to keep that real simple tonight. I think that's the key. You know, Florida can pop up. They make 8.5 threes a game, but they don't do it consistently. They've had games where they've made 13, and they've had games where they've made 2. So I think don't let Florida go crazy from the 3-point line, and then you get the game around the high 70s or in the 80s, early 80s, low 80s, that benefits LSU. If it gets down to 70 or below, it's going to benefit Florida. But I think us being at home with the momentum we've created in the last, you know, couple of games, winning at Kentucky, winning on the road at Georgia, I'm sure there's going to be a really supportive crowd there tonight. Yeah. I like LSU winning this game because I think we're going to score the ball, and I don't think Georgia can keep up with the pace that we're going to score it at.
Yeah, Florida, I mean, this is a huge game for Florida and their resume. They got a lot of work to do to get into the NCAA tournament, and this would be a gigantic step in that right direction for them. So that's their basis. And LSU's playing for, you know, they're playing to stay atop of the SEC leaderboard, and then they got a chance to take sole possession on Saturday. So there's a lot at stake for both clubs, and that's all you want. I mean, you're in late February, and it's a very significant game. That means you're pretty good.
Yes, sir. That's a great point. Everybody understands where LSU is, but that's a great point for Florida, Jordy, too. They need this game for their resume-building process to get them in the NCAA tournament. They're certainly not a lock to get in. No. I'm not even sure how close to the bubble they are, so this would be a huge win for them to get their 15th or 16th win with four or five games to go.
Have a great call, my friend. Enjoy it, man. It's great with a lot more bigger and better things. It's nice to be at home for three in a row, man. You can, you have to pack a suitcase and travel.
Well, it's been fun, though, but it is good to be home. And certainly, I think with the games that LSU has remaining, all they got to do is take care of the home court a little bit. I think it tilts their way down the stretch in terms of how the schedule rolls out for them.
I know Tennessee's a very good team. I wasn't impressed with them against Vandy last night. I guess they kind of sleptwalked through that one. But it should be a lot of fun Saturday if LSU will do as you say and take care of their business tonight. Man, I can't thank you enough for the time as always, but it's always fun talking with you. Have a great call of the game. We'll be listening.
Okay. Thanks, Jordy. Appreciate it.
All right, man. John Brady, color analyst on the LSU Sports Radio Network. Again, LSU, Florida, it's a big one. They're all big at this time of the year. It's relevant, significant, and important. It's about time. 6 o'clock tip, 5:30 pregame show right here on your source for LSU Sports, 103.7 The Game. We'll be back. Michael Hugenin, The Athletic, next.
Blonde Bomber is back and better than ever as you are locked into the Jordy Hultberg Show on 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com, and on the app.
Uh-oh, guess what day it is? Guess what day it is?
It's time to break down the biggest storylines this week with Michael Hugenin of The Athletic. What's up, Michael?
Mike, what day is it, Mike? Hump day!
Yes, indeed, it is Michael Hugenin of The Athletic kind enough to join us. Michael, you like rivalries, don't you? You like them.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just curious, what is the best rivalry out there in college sports?
Well, I still think it's Alabama-Auburn. I know that some folks are saying North Carolina-Duke is the best, and it obviously is. I think the difference with Alabama-Auburn, they play once. Last year, UNC and Duke played three times, twice in the regular season, once in the ACC tournament. I tend to think that absence makes the rivalry grow stronger. So if you only play one time in 365 days, it's a really good rivalry. I think Alabama-Auburn football is the best.
There you go. A lot of people say it's because of the proximity of Duke and North Carolina, 8 miles separating, the fact that they do play twice a year, sometimes three times a year, the fact that this is like the 46th time they've played in the top 10, and Duke has won 23 and North Carolina has won 22. Maybe that is kind of what separates it from Ohio State and Michigan football, because that's been a blowout for the Buckeyes.
Yeah, and that's also an extremely intense rivalry. And again, they play once a year. And Michigan-Ohio State basketball is not the same. just like North Carolina Duke North Carolina Duke football, rather, is not the same. So when you're talking rivalries, you got to say Alabama-Auburn football, North Carolina Duke basketball, Michigan-Ohio State football, because it's when Michigan and Ohio State play in basketball, fewer people care. And it is a big game tonight. Obviously, those are two of the best 10 teams in the country. The campuses are, 8 miles apart.
Right.
Extremely intense. You got the public school versus the private school. All that stuff's involved.
Great coaches, right?
And it's
great,
intense.
Great
but again,
players.
I still think Alabama Auburn football is the best college rivalry.
$2,500, lowest price to get in to see Duke Carolina. That's the Zion factor, right?
Oh yeah, and if you pay $2,500 to go watch a regular season basketball game, if you got that much money to spend, you probably don't care.
Why
what
not?
I do. But no, Zion Williamson. My assumption is this will be the last time he plays in a Duke North Carolina game on campus.
Yes.
Same with R.J. Barrett. It's high-level players, interesting coaches. The ACC regular season title's up for grabs still. So, yeah, it's an important game.
Speaking of money to spend, we talk about Michigan football. I see where old Harbaugh is going to take his team now to South Africa in May. I mean, it doesn't matter if he can't beat Ohio State. Doesn't matter how many wins or lost. They just keep going on these incredible, what was it, Paris, Rome, and now South Africa?
Yeah, and frankly, if you're a Michigan football player, this is pretty
awesome.
Darn cool.
Yes.
And I'll bet money you ask players at, for instance, LSU, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Clemson, Ohio State, hey, would you want to have spring practice on campus, or do you want to use part of your spring practice and go to Rome?
Yeah.
Or go to Ireland. I think every player would say, yeah, I want to go out of the country. So it's easy to take shots at Harbaugh, and he brings a lot of it on himself. But I actually think these trips are pretty darn cool, a really nice perk for college football players. College basketball players, I think people forget, often go overseas and play those exhibition games. So this is sort of the same kind of thing, except obviously they're not playing any games, but you're enriching your life thanks to football. So I think it's a gigantic positive.
I'm with you. Quite a recruiting tool, I would think.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. Okay. Michael Hugan and the Athletic, kind enough to join us. Nick Saban's staff has been announced, and it looks like he's going back to retreads. I mean, he's got a whole bunch of guys that used to coach for him that left, and now they're coming back to him, including at one time a one-year offensive coordinator, Major Applewhite, as the quote-unquote consultant this year.
Yeah, Applewhite, it's interesting. You talk to people, two or three years ago, Applewhite and Saban were like oil and water. They didn't get along. They didn't mix. And boom, comes the news yesterday that, just like Butch Jones, Major Applewhite's going to be an analyst for Alabama. The interesting thing about the Tide staff this year, last year they had 6 new assistants. This year it's 7. That's an incredible amount of turnover for a team that is that successful. Now, you can argue that he was glad to see some of those assistants leave, and I'm sure he was, and I'm sure, in fact, he told some of those guys who need to go. Tosh Lapoy was a phenomenal recruiter. Craig Kuligowski, their defensive line coach, not a high-level recruiter, but I would argue he might be the best defensive line coach in the nation. He also is extremely difficult to get along with, which is why he's had 3 jobs in the last 4 years. He was an assistant at Missouri with Barry Odom. Odom gets a head coaching job. Tells Kuligowski to leave, goes to Miami, is there for a year, leaves for Alabama. Now Saban is told him to move on. 7 new assistants. Again, that's an incredible number.
It really is.
For a program that's that successful. And the continuity aspect, coaches love to talk about continuity and how important it is. Saban seems to be hell-bent on proving that coaching staff continuity doesn't mean anything. If recruiting is about relationships, On some levels, then, Saban might be taking a risk, because if you had been recruited, for instance, by Mike Locksley, or recruited, for instance, by Craig Guligowski, or Tosh Lapoy, who's a great recruiter, all three of those guys are gone now.
And they still had the number one ranked recruiting class
exactly.
in the country.
So I think sometimes the relationship aspect is overblown. I think you look at a guy like Sal Sunseri, who Saban has brought back. When he was an assistant at Florida State in Florida, you heard all sorts of stuff. This guy's a really good coach, great technician, not a good recruiter. Well, in Alabama, people said, this guy's a great recruiter. Well, he's selling a little – his product is different, and he sells it well. So it is interesting that Florida was not upset to see Sal Sunseri leave from a recruiting standpoint at all. But Alabama is excited from a recruiting standpoint because Sunseri's back. So it all is a matter of how people – the perception of things. But, again, I would argue that if you're an assistant in Alabama – what you're selling is probably a little bit more important than relationships.
He is Michael Huguenin of The Athletic, kind enough to join us. We talked in about the transfer rule in past conversations. Are you of the belief that the transfer rule is one of the best things that the NCAA has done? In fact, when they cite that a coach can willingly transfer without repercussions, then so should players.
Yeah, I think it caught some people off guard by how many people enter the transfer portal. And those words are pretty scary. Charlie Strong on his National Signing Day news conference said that we're done with our recruiting, but we might bring in some transfers. You guys know there's more than 1,400 players who entered their names in the transfer portal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's 10 per team, 10 per school. Obviously, that's not some of those guys end up pulling their names out and that kind of stuff. But, I think the people who are, oh, my God, this is going to be the death of college football, that's way overblown. And you and I have talked about this many times. A quote-unquote normal college student can go to four schools in 4 years. No one cares. Why are athletes held to a different standard? And they're held to a different standard than their coaches. Coaches have contracts, and they break them willy-nilly.
Right.
Heck,
right.
You had coaches who were recruiting players who signed on National Signing Day, and those coaches were fired or, quote-unquote, left after signing day. So anybody who feels sorry for coaches, your sorrow – don't feel sorry for them. Plus, if you're Nick Saban, if you're Ed Orgeron, if you're Dan Mullen, if you're Ryan Day, if you're Harbaugh, you're making $4, 5, 6, 7 million a year. You can handle guys transferring out of your program.
Absolutely. Michael Huguenin, The Athletic. But I thought about this, and I'm curious as to why they did away with it. When I was being recruited, it was a 4-year scholarship. Then for some reason they stopped that. Now it's a 1-year renewable, maybe under the guise of, we're going to do you however many years you need. But why do they do away with the wording? It's not a 4-year deal. It's now a 1-year renewable.
Some schools are given 4-year scholarships and they're making a big deal about it. But that goes back to the coach wielding all the power. You're here for a year. I don't like you. You're gone. I'm done. You're not getting a scholarship next year. So, again, that's another example of coaches and how much power they wield. So, let's get serious also. Most of the time, the guys transferring are backups. So why, presumably, does a coach truly care that a guy he doesn't think can start is leaving? Doesn't that give you an opportunity to go out and find somebody that might be better than the guy that's leaving? So, I'm fully for transfers. Now, I get the fact that, the immediate eligibility aspect of transfers, I'll even admit, and maybe I'm being a little hypocritical, is a little bit bothersome. But maybe there's going to be a new rule put in where if here's your scholarship and at any time in your years at the school at which you initially signed, you're allowed to transfer with no penalty. It's only once. That's it.
One time.
So,
if you
could be a high school student in Lafayette, Louisiana, you could sign with Arkansas And 2 years into your time at Arkansas, the entire coaching staff leaves. Why can't you leave too if you want to?
Yes.
Those, I mean, I know you're supposed, you're signing with the school. You know, that's what everybody says. And yes, I think there are legit some kids who do. I don't care who the coach is. I'm going to that school.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get serious though. The whole relationship thing makes it more like, hey, I like this coach. I like this school more than I like that coach at that school. So I'm going to go sign at school A. And when the coach leaves, maybe the player should be allowed to leave as well.
Makes perfect sense to me. It just common sense though gets in the way of things,
yes.
Doesn't it? It just
yes,
it just really, really does. Speaking of coaches, how about ex Minnesota coach Kill talking about PJ Fleck that he's all about himself. He doesn't care about the players. What brought that on?
That's a good question. It's obvious that Jerry Kill does not like PJ Fleck anymore. Now I would argue that Jerry Kill, you're the athletic director at Southern Illinois. Why are you denigrating a coach at a different school?
Right.
That's a little bit bush league to me. Now, maybe Kill intensely dislikes Fleck now. Fleck used to be an assistant for him. I just thought it was a bad look for Kill. Though P.J. Fleck does rub a lot of people the wrong way. I think a lot of people think that's false enthusiasm.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really not Jerry Kill's responsibility to worry about that anymore. Yes, he did coach at Minnesota. He does not coach there anymore, and frankly, I don't think people in Minnesota, the higher-ups, truly care what Jerry Kill thinks about.
That's right. That's right. Anybody in other than Gus Malzahn, which is every year at Auburn, he's on the watch list of the first coach to be fired. Is there anybody else in the league?
They're obviously not firing Chad Morris or Jeremy Pruitt, but I think
right.
those two guys, those two programs – both recruited well. Obviously, Tennessee better than Arkansas. I think they need to make strides. If Tennessee goes 5-7 again, I think the Tennessee fan base is going to revolt. Arkansas should be better than 2-10. Can they get to 6-6 and get to a bowl? That would be gigantic strides. It will be interesting to see what happens at South Carolina if they backslide some because they underachieved last year, I think. And I think some of their fans are starting to realize, you know, Will Muschamp, maybe there's a reason Florida fired that guy. But I don't think anybody's really in any mm-hmm. danger. Though, you know, Matt Luke, I don't think he's on firm footing at all. If they lose, have a losing season, 5-7, I can see Ole Miss getting rid of Matt Luke. The problem, obviously, if you're Matt Luke, you took over a program that was being
yes.
investigated by the NCAA.
Yeah.
Then sanctions come down, and then you're still in the news because you were forced to vacate wins. I can see Matt Luke being on the hot seat as well. But, no, not as hot as Malzahn, because I think expectations at Auburn are such that if they don't win 10, no matter what, Gus Malzahn is seen as a failure, whereas I would argue Matt Luke getting that team to 5-7 last year was a pretty good job considering the obstacles they faced. Shea Patterson left, a bunch of other guys left, so I think he's done a pretty good job keeping everybody on the same ship, for instance, to use a metaphor. I mean, no one is deserting since those guys left at the beginning of last year. I think Matt Luke's done a pretty nice job keeping everything together, but yeah, I think he's in trouble going into the season.
And the one coach everybody thought was going to be on the hot seat's now going to have a contract extension and a raise, and that's Ed Orgeron. How about that?
Yeah, but still, if you're Coach O, I don't think you want to. You certainly don't want to test the fans' faith by going 7-5.
I don't think
this team is going to go 7-5. Obviously, I think last year's team, on paper, looked that's going to be a tough season, and they ended up having a really nice season. And you look at the 2019 schedule, like we did last week, and you're like, this team should win 10 games.
Easily, that would be disappointing to win 10. I think they think they could win more than that, but we'll see. We'll see. All right, Michael Hugenin, keep your eye on those LSU Tigers in basketball. They're pretty darn good, my friend. They're pretty good.
Yeah, and the Florida team they're playing tonight struggles offensively, and they are really, really small. So I know LSU rebounds extremely well. They should crush Florida on the boards. But Florida plays really intense in-your-face defense.
And the
only way Florida wins is if the game's in the 60s. If it's in the 70s, Florida ain't winning.
He is Michael Hugan of The Athletic, the best of the business. Thank you, my friend.
Talk to you next week. Appreciate it.
All right. There you go. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back. This is The Jordy Helfberg Show.
Only one place you'll find all of the movers, the shakers, and Tigers newsmakers. And it's right here on the Jordy Helfberg Show on 103.7 The Game.
All right, we're back at 54 minutes after the hour. Tie up a couple of loose ends here before we wrap up hour number one, set the stage for hour number two. The SEC grabbed both the National Association of Basketball Coaches National Team of the Week, the LSU Tigers, and the United Sports Basketball Writers Association National Player of the Week, P.J. Washington of Kentucky. There has been a transfer. Dominique Livingston, defensive lineman, released a statement today citing family issues as his reason for leaving LSU to pursue a transfer somewhere back home in Texas. He's a 6'3", 350-pound defensive tackle who redshirted his freshman season this fall. He entered the NCAA transfer portal February the 13th. So Livingston appeared in just one game in 2018. It came late in LSU's final home game against Rice, when most of the backups came in. He had no tackles. This is the first season when the transfer portal has been in use, as the NCAA eliminated the procedure where transfers needed to get permission from their current school before receiving another scholarship. So you can see that Ed Orgeron anticipated this. He's already got four defensive linemen in the early commitment stages of the 2020 class. Dominique Livingston probably saw the handwriting. Well, look, I believe the kid. I have no reason not to. Due to family issues. So he says, I wish the entire LSU family my absolute best in the future. So we wish you the best of luck, too. Got to go where you need to go and where you're going to be happy. Dominique Livingston leaving LSU. We're going to leave for a short break. We'll come back for hour number two. Hot topics, as always, with producer extraordinaire Clint Domain. Brody Miller on the very latest on the 4-0, still number one ranked LSU baseball Tigers. And Steve Stricker is the newly named captain of the U.S. Ryder Cup. Is it the good old boys club yet again? Is he what does it take to be a good Ryder Cup captain? Because obviously the ones they've had recently haven't been worth a flying Walinda. Team USA is getting hammered. That, some birthday wishes, and on this day in sports history, coming up hour number two on Acadiana's number one sports station, 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com. LSU hoops tonight, 5:30 pregame, tip 6 o'clock right here on your source for LSU sports, KLWB 103.7 The Game. Come on back. Hour number two, straight ahead.
Live from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette.
Tigers pull off another miracle.
This is Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game.
Touchdown, New Orleans!
Streaming live on the 103.7 The Game mobile app and online at 103.7thegame.com.
He struck him out, and the Tigers have won!
This is the Jordy Helfberg Show. Get involved and call 337-706-0111. Follow along at 1037 The Game on Facebook and Twitter. And now it's time. Here's your host, Jordy Helfberg.
Hour number two of two, and away we go. Hey, kids, thanks for telling Mom to turn the radio station to 1037 The Game so you can listen to us as you're heading home before you start all that homework and stuff. It's great to be with you. CD, in the 237 Roof Studios Master Control Suite. He's taking care of business. Yours truly here. And away we go. We talked about it in hour number one. If you missed our interview with John Brady previewing LSU versus Florida hoops, which you can listen to here on 103.7 The Game, 5:30 pregame, 6 o'clock tip, just go to 103.7thegame.com, 103.7thegame.com, and you can find it there. Coming up in this hour, we'll talk LSU baseball with Brody Miller. We'll talk PGA golf. The Ryder Cup captain has been named. His name is Steve Stricker. We'll talk to Alex Myers of Golf Digest about that. But without further ado, as we start off hour number two each and every day, let's take our daily walk around the sports water cooler. CD, hit that button, baby.
Here's today's Hot Topics, brought to you by Cajun Chef. Spice up your life with Cajun Chef products. Delectably delicious, decidedly better.
All right, Clinton, good afternoon, sir. Fire away at will whenever you're ready.
What is going on, Jordy, on this Wednesday? Still a little dreary out there after all the rain that we had last night. Thankfully, none of it interfered with LSU baseball here on 103.7 The Game.
Yeah. That's right. I was on standby just in case.
Yeah. I believe you, Jordy, but like I said, just so much going on with LSU baseball last night against Southeastern, back and forth, back and forth. And then an unlikely hero in Brock Mathis gets the win for the Tigers over Southeastern. Were you concerned at all about that game, Jordy, especially after that hit Josh Smith took?
Yeah, heck yeah. As Paul Maneri said, I saw the whole season flashing in front of him. The biggest takeaway I got out of that, the bullpen's pretty good. When you can pull out Matthew Beck and Devin Fontenot and then hand the ball to Todd Peterson, that's pretty darn good. So some veterans coming out of your bullpen to settle it down and go from there. Cole Henry with a not so great debut, but that's, you know, you give them a pass, you let them settle in, and let's see what happens the next time they get on the bump. But hey, 4-0 is 4-0. Yep. You just want to keep winning.
Exactly, Jordy. You need to just keep winning, moving forward. I like what I saw from LSU last night. Got that ability to bounce back, and we talk about Todd Peterson. Man, you know, we talk about how he was hitting dingers in a BP, apparently. Dude's not half bad on the mound either, so no, it's definitely huge for LSU to have him as a potential closer.
He was throwing it hard and on target, so it's good to know that, you know, you give him the ball, he can go maximum two innings, but he's going to pitch hard and throw it hard, and he's super, super, super confident in his own abilities, and that's what you need as a closer.
Yeah, exactly, Jordy. Definitely a lot to look forward to, especially heading into this weekend. You're up against a no-name team in Bryant, wherever the heck they're from. Actually, they're from Rhode Island, Jordy.
Rhode Island.
But it's just, you've got this weekend kind of to set everything up and really see who else is going to be in there to be ready to go in case of an emergency break glass type situation if you have your boy Josh Smith or anybody else, heaven forbid, get hurt and is out for a few games. I think this is the perfect time to do that, right?
Play a lot of people. As long as you have the games intact, you can't overlook these teams. But you're looking to see how Zach Hess improves from week one to week two. You're looking to see how the infielders all handle it. You get some new players in there, back and forth. So, yeah, it's a good time to tinker a little bit.
And we're still in the All-Star break, Jordy. NBA is about to get started in a couple days, but people are talking about, as we near the end of the season, the MVP. Who in your mind is definitely making a strong case to be that MVP in 2019?
It's a two-horse race, I think. Three-horse race. I think it's James Harden. Okay. I think it's Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Greek freak. And I think it's Paul George, believe it or not. I think he's had a terrific season. So those three right here right now. And Milwaukee's got the best record in the East. I'm going to give it to the Giannis as we speak right here, right now. But time will tell.
I'd agree with you, Jordy. I think we got to give it to Giannis because the dude is just taking this team almost out of obscurity into some relevancy, especially during the All-Star break. They're one of the top teams in that Eastern Conference. It's going to be fun to see what happens.
It's a horse race. You know, the Eastern Conference is going to be a great run to the finish line with four teams seriously in contention. Boston, Toronto, Philly, and who am I forgetting? Boston, Philly, Toronto, and Milwaukee. Milwaukee. Yeah, those four, of course.
Exactly. How can you not say this is going to be a fun Eastern Conference playoffs? It's not going to be like it has been over the last, like, 10 years, where it's LeBron James getting to the finals and everybody else is trying to get to second place.
That's so exactly
it's right. A little refreshing, Jordy.
Yes, yes.
Moving over to college basketball, of course, the biggest game of the week, and I'd probably say the biggest game of the year, is Duke-UNC tonight. Mm-hmm. Zion Williamson going to be in the house, the Battle of Tobacco Road. We talked about it a little bit yesterday, Jordy, more about the fact you're paying $2,000 to get into the building. But my question to you today is, Jordy, who's your favorite all-time player from Duke-UNC when it comes to this rivalry?
Ooh, all-time favorite player. Well, I mean, Michael Jordan's got to be right there. I mean, my goodness gracious. I used to love to watch Phil Ford play. Now, that's going way back in time. That's when Dean Smith was coaching. He put the four corners in, and you just couldn't take the ball away from him. There's so many. There's too many great players in it, too many great coaches. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Roy Williams. It's a tremendous rivalry because this is the 46th matchup between the two teams when they've been ranked in the top 10. All right. Duke has won 23 of the 45 and the 40. Yeah. And North Carolina's won 22. So it's a great rivalry because they both win. And so tonight will be the installment. Can Carolina even the schedule at 23 apiece, or does Duke take a 2-game lead? I think Duke at home. Tough to beat, man. Tough to beat.
I mean, they're just tough to beat, period, Jordy, especially with the guys that they have. Three undoubtedly top five picks in the 2019 draft.
Yeah.
And, of course, Zion Williams, he actually mentioned he put on 100 pounds over the last 2 years, Jordy.
Wow.
And he's able to do the things that he does. That is impressive.
He is like a Mack truck in a ballet, and he doesn't miss a beat. And he just moves along so smoothly and effortlessly. He is a one-of-a-kind type of a player. There's no question about that. He's fun to watch. Must-see TV, and I can't wait to watch it.
I think everybody is looking forward to this game tonight between Duke and UNC. But, of course, we've got LSU basketball coming up a little bit later on today at 6 o'clock tip. Of course, I know you'll be watching that. I'll be listening to it on 103.7 The Game. It's going to be a phenomenal matchup between LSU and Florida right before the main course of LSU and Tennessee on Saturday.
That's a wonderful Wednesday of hoops, man. Oh, they got to come up with a name for it.
Yeah, I know they have Super Tuesday on Tuesday nights on the Four-Letter Network, but Wonderful Wednesday, I think that works out quite well.
There you go.
It's definitely, Hump Day Hoops would probably be a great
hump
one.
Hump Day Hoops, I love it.
Alliteration.
That's it.
We just crushed it there, Jordy. But looking at the LSU-Florida game tonight, obviously LSU can't overlook it. Which player is going to have a big performance tonight to get that win over Florida and be able to get ready to take on Tennessee with a lot on the line?
They go as Tremont Waters takes them. If Tremont Waters has a good game, LSU will be just fine. So watch Trey Waters, and if he's doing his thing, taking good shots when they're available, getting in the lane and distributing the basketball, LSU will be just fine. Just fine. There you have it. There's our hot topics for the day. Thank you, CD. That brought to you by the best hot sauce on the planet, Cajun Chef Hot Sauce, the Biart family for nearly 9 years now, getting it done and getting it done right. Bring a little small bottle with you wherever you go because everything tastes better with Cajun Chef hot sauce on it. LSU baseball's better. They're 4-0. We'll get the lowdown from Brody Miller. NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune, next on this Hump Day edition. Hump Day of Hoops on the Jordy Helpert Show. We'll be right back.
Sing them in gasoline. It's the Jordy Hultberg Show on Acadiana Sports Station. 103.7 The Game.
All right, LSU baseball is 4-0, but like LSU basketball, they seem to have to come from behind game after game after game. Let's get a four-game report from our good friend Brody Miller, NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune, who's got the gig this year to cover the Tigers. Brody, how are you?
I am phenomenal. How are you doing?
Man, I love the enthusiasm. That's awesome.
I just had a, I just had a great sandwich at City Fork, so life couldn't be better.
Oh, and you're not having to go to Natchitoches, although Natchitoches is a beautiful village, but you're not having to go there. Okay. let's see. I guess over the weekend, the big talk was the freshman pictures, and then I guess the talk after beating Southeastern would be the veterans coming out of the bullpen. Would that kind of sum things up?
Yeah, no, that's a perfect way to put it. I mean, pretty much, I mean, the talk going into the season, I would argue, is, you know, how loaded this pitching staff is and all that and how deep they are, and some of that's perpetuated by me, I admit. But you have these three-star freshman pitchers who, you know, in Landon Marceau, Jaden Hill, and Cole Henry, who are these, you know, I mean, these guys all turned down seven figures from MLB teams to come to college. And Landon Marceau and Jaden Hill absolutely looked the part. I mean, Landon Marceau, the funny thing is, didn't even have a very good game in his eyes. He was mad at himself. His changeup wasn't locating. And he allowed two hits in 5 2/3 innings and just one run, you know. And then on Sunday, you know, Jaden Hill comes out. He's a guy who has really good stuff, but kind of had to learn some little just like nuances, just kind of how to be a pitcher, how to change speeds, when to pitch certain things and all that. And he came out and allowed, I think 4 hits in 5 innings, struck out 8 batters. I mean, his stuff just looked filthy, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those guys, you know, passed with flying colors this weekend. Cole Henry did not have as good of a game, you know, didn't make it through 3 innings on Tuesday. You know, gave up, I think, 7 hits in 2 2/3, 3 runs, and 4 runs and 3 earned runs.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great outing, but then, you know, you come out, that bullpen, and that's where this depth shows up, is you have experienced bullpen guys in Devin Fontenot, Matthew Beck, and Todd Peterson, who shut a Southeastern team down the final 5 innings. I think they gave up probably 2 hits the last 5 innings off the top of my head.
Wow.
I mean, and then you have, and I think what's encouraging is kind of, it's encouraging and discouraging, is it was a game where, you know, the offense did not look good by any stretch of the imagination, but hey, you kind of, that's a good sign of a team, in my opinion, is when you can find ways to kind of inch out wins when you don't have it, and that offense kind of found a way to small ball its way into a win.
I'm with you. One common denominator, and you did a story on this, and I want your thoughts on it, but these freshman pitchers seem to love the guy that wasn't supposed to be the starting catcher, but because of an injury where Saul Garza is the DH, Brock Mathis doesn't seem like he wants to give that position up, does he?
I know. I mean, I guess I'll leave that story down the line, but that's going to be the most interesting thing about how they manage that situation in a month. But,
yeah.
But absolutely, Brock Mathis, Brock Mathis is a guy that it's important to mention. The Pulmonary spent so much of this offseason, as you know, talking about it wasn't even just the ability of last year's catchers that was disappointing, but it was mm-hmm. you know, not having that personality he likes. He wants that take charge, vocal guys, not afraid to get in the pitcher's face, get a pitcher, you know, going, light the team up, be the captain of that infield. And they did not have that last year. And I think, you know, Brock Mathis, I mean, he has plenty of flaws in his game. His bat hasn't looked great through 4 games. You know, I'm not sure about his ability to throw to second base yet, but, well, mm-hmm. I'm just not sure. But I mean, he fits that vocal leader thing to a T. I mean, it's, every single pitcher I talked to had a different little mini anecdote about just, you know, he got my face and said, all right, me and you, let's do this today, you know, to a freshman mm-hmm. pitcher before his first start. Or, you know, he got Todd Peterson fired up before he came in to close the game out. I think he's really good at that. He's good at kind of managing a lot of guys, and also he's good at defense. I mean, in just the basic ways, he's looked really good framing some pitches when Jaden Hill was pitching, even more specifically when Jaden Hill was pitching. You know, Jaden Hill's trying out this new breaking ball that he's only been working on been using more this past few months.
Mm-hmm.
And he's putting balls in the dirt with runners in scoring position. And Brock Mathis is perfectly blocking a few of those balls. So, I mean, granted, it's a small sample size, but Brock Mathis has been that defensive leader that they really want there.
He is Brody Miller, NOLA.com, the Times Picayune. Now, tell me what happened with Josh Smith. He caught one right in the chops. What happened there?
Yeah, it appeared it went right in his mouth.
Wow.
You know, none of his. Yeah, no, it was 87 miles an hour right in the mouth. And, yeah, Pulmonary said that he's like, yeah, I saw our whole season going down the drain when that happened. I know in the dugout, people were kind of going, Todd Peterson for one, but several players were kind of going bonkers in the dugout, fired up, kicking and screaming about their leader. You know, Josh Smith is the vocal leader of the entire, you know, lineup, I would say. And So you have that happen and gets everyone fired up. But from what I understand, you know, no concussion symptoms, no loose teeth or anything like that. Just I know, right? Kind of crazy. But just two busted lips.
Wow. Unbelievable. That kind of got, you said it got Todd Peterson kind of fired up. I heard the jugs gun was hitting three figures almost.
Yeah, it was, I mean, Todd Peterson threw hard as is. There's no doubt about it. He's somebody you can probably trust to hit 95, 96. But yeah, no, so when Josh Smith goes down, you know, several different teammates said Todd Peterson, of all people, was just up and down the dugout, kicking, screaming, just yelling, so angry and fired up. He said after the game, he's like, I'd die for Josh Smith. When I saw that happen, I knew I'd die for him and do anything for him. And Todd Peterson's already an emotional guy, but this was times five. And he goes out there and hits 98, which, you know, pretty I saw it at least twice. And Paul Maneri said he's never seen him, you know, touch 98 before. I don't know if anyone's even seen him hit 97 before. But he came out there in that last inning, sat him down in order, struck out the final two batters, and, you know, he kind of proved to Paul Maneri that he can be that closer because, I mean, granted, it's not the best competition, but, you know, his sample size last year when he won that closer role, he looked really good for a month, but it was only, you know, six or seven saves. I mean, save situations, wasn't too many. So I think it was encouraging for him to come in this situation, you know, close game, high-intensity game, and kind of prove himself again.
Brody, Paul Maneri is not one known very much for laying the bat down on the ball and putting the ball in play via the bunt, but he had a pair of bunts, sacrifice bunts, that were key to the game, and, man, they executed it to perfection.
Absolutely. It was kind of fitting that literally 2 weeks ago, Paul Maneri said, if I remember correctly, you know, Chris Reed somebody, because it was about him coming back to the team after 6 months away, and he said, you know, Chris Reed's somebody who I think could go 10 years without picking up a bat and go up and give you a professional at bat and, you know, do what you need to do. And then here he is. He comes up 2 weeks later, pinch hitting with a runner on first in a tie game. And he had a class up until 3 o'clock for a 4 p.m. game because Maneri made him go to class. So he didn't have time to do any batting practice. All he had time for was 20 swings off the tee. and then he comes up in this clutch situation, and obviously he didn't get a big hit or anything like that, but, you know, he gets a swing that buys DiGiacomo just enough time to steal second on a hit and run, and then lays down that perfect bunt down the third baseline to put DiGiacomo at third base, and then that set up Brock Mathis' single that eventually won the game. And yeah, I mean, they played a little bit of small ball, because then you mentioned two bunts, because then there was also Grant Broussard's bunt in the seventh inning that put Josh Smith from first to third. Right. I mean, they've got some speed on this team. They've got enough kind of mix of crafty veteran guys, which is speedy guys, that you kind of want to play a little small ball occasionally. But like you said, it's kind of funny that just 2 days earlier he said, I didn't bring Cade Beloso to bunt, and then he drops two bunts in the clutch.
Yeah, exactly. Brody Miller, NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. The Bryant Bulldogs coming to Baton Rouge for a three-game weekend series. Maybe not your classic matchup, but they tell me it's a pretty good baseball school. I have no clue.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be truly honest with you. I don't have much information on them as well. I think the main thing that you'd be looking for to follow this weekend is just, you know, just kind of keep monitoring the unknowns, because, you know, it'll be Landon Marceau and Jane Hill's second start.
Zach Hess. That's what everybody wants to know about. What's going on with him?
No, you're absolutely right, actually. That is the number one thing. I actually genuinely slipped my mind, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, you know, I saw Zach Hess talking to a former pitcher in the parking lot after a game after Friday's game. I saw, you know, on Sunday night he was out, you know, after everyone was inside. It was a cold night. Him and Alan Dunn were out in the dugout doing long toss, working on some stuff. I think Zach Hess is, you know, I don't want to speculate too much, but I think he sees those freshmen dominating right now.
And he sees, hey,
I gotta get this stuff figured out if I want to keep this spot.
Yeah. What's the latest on Mikhail Hilliard? How's his rehab or whatever's going on with him?
Yeah, good question. So he, he was not available this past weekend or on Tuesday. He has more soreness. So that's something that's going to, you know, my guess is going to be a thing for as long as he's here, it seems like, at this point, because we're going on, you know, going on about 8 months, if I think I'm right, 8 months of him having issues with that shoulder soreness. Yeah. And then, yeah, you know, and there's no identifiable clear issue. So I think it's a weird situation there, let's put it that way. And he was unavailable. And then Easton McMurray, the only left-handed pitcher on the whole staff, he was also unavailable. He was seeing the doctor, I believe, yesterday. So we'll get more on that tomorrow. But yeah. But in general, I guess those are the only two major injuries on this team.
Were they pleased with the performance of Eric Walker, and are they going to give him more work? And if so, when?
Yes. So they were definitely pleased. I mean, he looked fantastic in those two and a third innings he threw. And I, you know, all those things that you love about him, you know, his command, his ability to put a fastball or a changeup wherever he wants it, those were all there. You know, so he was supposed to obviously start today against Northwestern State, and then he would have thrown yesterday, you know, in relief after Cole Henry, but then he came in with a stomach bug yesterday. Pulmonary said you'll probably see Eric Walker pitch in relief Friday. I think the really interesting thing would be to see how much he throws, you know, because you want to get him more innings. You want to let him stretch that arm out a little bit. So I'm curious to see if they let him go, you know, three or four innings. I don't even know if they'd have an opportunity to do that either.
And here's another one that sees these newcomers coming up, and he was supposed to be the Sunday starter, and like, uh-oh, I better get back and get healthy quick.
Yeah, I mean, you're mixing that with the end, like, and just the fact that each of his starts keeps getting postponed for different things. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it was already going to be 2 to 3 weeks that he'd be coming out of the midweek. Now he's pushed back another week, so who knows if it's going to be a month before we see Eric Walker get that weekend spot. And like you said, if at all.
If at all. He is Brody Miller. Got a day off, had a great sandwich. He is feeling absolutely phenomenal. And we're thankful to have you on today, my friend. Take care. We'll talk soon.
All right. Take care. Have a good one.
All right. Brody Miller, NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. We'll take a time out here. Come back with more. This is the Jordy Helfberg Show. Sit tight.
Play cards with a guy whose last name is a state. Don't spit into the wind. And always get your sports talk from the Jordy Helfberg Show. Live and local. 103.7 The Game.
Hey, we welcome you back. This is the Jordy Helfberg Show. Big news in the world of golf today, as Steve Stricker was named the U.S. Ryder Cup captain, becoming the first American to serve in the role despite never having won a major championship. I had to get in touch with our golf analyst, Alex Myers, Golf Digest, to get his opinion on the 29th U.S. captain. So, Alex, good day. How have you been, sir?
Good, thanks, Jordy. I knew you'd call because I know the Ryder Cup is your favorite event. So
yeah. It is. So it's in Wisconsin next year at Whistling Straits. Was this a surprise to you with Mr. Stricker getting the nod?
No. You know, it's kind of been bubbling, you know, that this would be the case the last few months at least. Yeah, you mentioned Wisconsin. You know, he's a native Wisconsinite. You see him always rooting on the Badgers at the NCAA tournament and at football games, although he actually went to the University of Illinois, Steve Stricker, but definitely a Wisconsin guy at heart. And, you know, the venue, you know, in his home, in his backyard kind of makes sense, I guess. I think they're reading a little too much into that because, you know, obviously not everywhere you go, someone's going to have a local tie there. But but certainly he has the respect and the admiration of the players. You mentioned he is the first captain to not have a major championship on his resume to captain the U.S. team for the Ryder Cup. But the European side has done that a bunch of times, including Thomas Bjorn last year, including Paul McGinley a couple years in 2014. And those guys have been very successful. So, you know, it really comes down to do the guys get along with the captain. You know, we saw Tom Watson not get along with his players. He has eight majors. So, you know, the more is that the chemistry is there and the respect is definitely there. So I think it's a good pick overall. And certainly Steve's been involved with a lot of these teams. He's captained the President's Cup and he's been a three-time assistant captain for the Ryder Cup already.
Maybe that's not a good formula because the U.S. has been dominated in the competition, losing four of the past five. The only victory coming in Hazeltine in 2016, they were routed in Paris. I got a text message from someone who loves the game of golf, and he says it's the good old boy network. How do you respond to something like that?
Well, you know, after 2014, when Phil Mickelson kind of in the middle of that press conference, you know, took aim at Tom Watson, the captain, he kind of said that the players need to be more involved. There needs to be sort of this task force committee, and that's what was created. And, you know, since then, there's definitely been more more talk, more planning for this event. Now, you're right. How many people are involved in that planning is one of the issues, maybe. And I know part of that original task force, Steve Stricker was on that. I think it was about 12 people. So, mm-hmm. you know, you talk about it's probably Steve Stricker, it's Phil Mickelson, it's Tiger Woods. And yes, Steve Stricker is one of Tiger's good friends. We've seen them obviously paired together at events. We've seen them sharing putting tips and mm-hmm. what have you. So you're right. There is a certain aspect of are you in the crowd or are you not in the crowd here? But that crowd now has at least bought in to this event, has invested a lot of time and energy into it. You know, again, Steve Stricker has put in his time. He's been an assistant right. three times. And, you know, he did lead the team. Yes, it's the President's Cup. The U.S. always wins the President's Cup. But he did lead the U.S. to a dominant victory in 2017 at Liberty National. So he did have the commands then. Tiger has said he was great. He's learning from him as he becomes the President's Cup this year. So, you know, he's put in his time, and again, he just has the respect of the players. Despite never having won a major, he obviously was a really good player, 12 PGA Tour wins, and he could still go out there and play over the age of 50.
Does he have – I mean, we've asked you this before, and I still don't know the answer. I mean, you got to have respect, obviously. You have to have a little – I don't know. How does a captain these multimillionaires who are out there playing on the court? How do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's a tough question. No, it's a tough question. You're right. And again, that's where you would think you would need a guy with majors, because why would someone, you know – a Jordan Spieth with three majors listen to a guy who's never won any majors. But, you know, mm-hmm. again, he's a certain personality that everyone, you know, vibes with and gets along with. And you know, people still respect his career. Just because he doesn't win a major doesn't mean he can't tell you something. He's been in all the situations that you could imagine. Mm-hmm. He's obviously been in the you know, in contention at majors. He's played in multiple Ryder Cups, multiple Presidents Cups. Again, he rubs elbows with Tiger Woods. I mean, so he, you know, he's done about everything you can do in golf except win a major. So, you know, for him to take the reins here, certainly, you know, a guy who is very familiar with this crew of people. Obviously, there's always turnover every year at these events, even from the right. Presidents Cup to the Ryder Cup, but you do know there is going to probably be that core: Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth struggling right now, but he'll probably be there. Ricky Fowler, and now you know Tiger and Phil are probably still right on the edge of still making these teams as well. So you do know at least half the team probably at this point, and obviously Stricker is very familiar and very well liked amongst that crew.
Alex Myers, Golf Digest. Is the point system the best way to go about this? Because sometimes players get hot at the right time and they right. don't have enough points and they're not included. I guess that could be captain's picks.
Right.
But do you like the system as is?
You know, I wish there were probably more captain's picks, to be honest. You raise a really good point. I think you know, they've gone back and forth, and I think it is at the four people right now is a better number. But you know, you could almost make a case it should be half the team that's captain's pick, because you're right, you want to pick the guys who are playing well at the end. And I know a few years ago, the one year they won in 2016, they allowed for that last pick to happen right after the tour championship. That mm-hmm. got Ryan Moore on the team. He was playing really well. He ended up, you know, probably just a coincidence, but he ends up getting that winning point at Hazeltine. But then they went away with that the next year, and they wanted to pick the team a little earlier, which, you know, for logistical reasons, I get it. But like you said, you kind of want the hot hand. It's a two-year system, but it's really not a two-year system, because it's only counting the majors and the World Golf Championships from this year. And then next okay. year it will be all the regular events. But that being said, you know, we've seen instances where – you know, not to call out a name here or anything, but Zach Johnson wins the British Open in 2015, and then he makes a team in 2016 despite having done really nothing all year in
right.
2016, but he gets that right. major. Yeah, so from that perspective, I would like it to just be the 1 year. I agree. I mean, just kind of keep it to that 1 year and have as many captain's picks as possible. I think that gets you the best squad possible.
I'm with you. Let's go with who's hot and who's not, and then let's you got to figure out how to pair these people together. So much controversy in the last Ryder Cup, but just, I mean, those that are in the know kept saying, why are they together? What's going on with that? And I guess that is the biggest decision of them all.
That is. I mean, certainly once we get to the event, I know the captain has all these duties leading up to the event, this and that. I mean, a lot of it, let's be honest, is attending different functions and this and that, and, taking pictures with the trophies. But once it all starts, their main job is making those pairings. You're right. And that is key. And that, you know, that's something that, again, they're starting to have these events throughout the year. I know that, you know, they met at Jack Nicklaus's house, I think, last year, and had a dinner with all the prospective team members. And, you know, they do certain things like that. They took a trip to France last year ahead of it. Didn't work, obviously. But they took a trip over there and kind of, you know, with some of the guys who might make the team and got to know the course a little better. So they are doing more of these things a little ahead of time, being a little more proactive and building that team chemistry. But you're right. It's tough to find guys who, you know, find great pairings. And now even when they do find a great pairing, like Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed, they break it up. So,
I got an idea, Alex. Okay. Why doesn't Steve Stricker make it mandatory? He knows the pool of players that he's going to be picking from. Make them come down to New Orleans and play. It's a pairings golf tournament.
Yes.
And see how that works.
Oh, I like that. That's a good idea. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that'd be interesting, actually, even to go back. Obviously, you mentioned the Zurich Classic. It's been a team event, I think, for 2 years now.
Yes.
I wonder how many, Ryder Cup or President's Cup pairings have actually played together in that event. I bet it's pretty limited amount. Although I think Justin Rose and Stenson might have done it. But, yeah, no, you're right. That would be a good little test there for sure. And, Steve Stricker's going to have some interesting calls on his hand because we mentioned Patrick Reed. What do you do with Patrick Reed? He obviously had some comments to the team afterwards, after France, that weren't taken so well and everything else. And, it's going to be interesting. But, again, Stricker's the type of guy that it seems like he's not a rah-rah guy. He's not going to get in your face. But he does seem to, you know, unify guys and make them feel comfortable. So hopefully he at least can kind of bridge the gap with some of these players.
I think it's just I think it's a must. Get them in an environment where they can be in a pairing and see how they respond to one another. It just makes too much sense for me. I'll be your vice captain when you're the Ryder Cup captain. Let me ask you this. Will David Toms ever be in consideration for a Ryder Cup captainship?
Well, I mean, I think, unfortunately, the time has kind of passed him by. And, you know, you're right. I mean, we've mentioned already a couple times how Stricker hasn't won a major. You know, it used to be you had to win a PGA championship to kind of get the Ryder Cup gig. They've obviously gone away from that, but David Toms does have that PGA championship. I'm sure he's maybe felt a little passed over. And another interesting name, what about Fred Couples? Now, again, we don't know if he's been offered and he's turned it down, but he has done the President's Cup, I believe, 3 times. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, very successful. Again, the President's Cup, we put an asterisk there because the U.S. always kicks the international's butt.
Right.
But except for one time. But, you know, Fred Couples for a while, they're like, well, yeah, you know, he won the Masters, but he never won a PGA Championship. So the PGA of America is not going to give him the gig, which is a ridiculous rule, obviously.
Yes.
Fred Couples is a, you know, Hall of Famer, was a former number one player and obviously a well-liked guy. So, you know, maybe this will open the door to other guys like that. David Toms, you mentioned, he kind of did fit the bill for a future Ryder Cup. But it's going to be tough because now you're getting into, you know, Tiger's already a President's Cup captain. He loves this stuff. You know, Phil Mickelson is itching to be a captain as well. And those guys are coming up and, you know, you're going to give them the reins before you give David Toms the reins. So that it looks like he's probably not going to be it.
I'm curious. You said that Stricker's not a get-in-your-face kind of a captain.
Right.
Has there been a get-in-your-face captain that would call players out, or who would that be?
Well, I think Tom Watson was a little too much get-in-your-face in 2014, and despite the fact that he is Tom Watson, you know, 8-time major, one of the greatest players of all time, I think the age gap was just too much to overcome, and I just don't think it worked. I don't think it rubbed some of these guys the right way. It certainly didn't rub Phil Mickelson the right way, that's for sure. And he took him to task for that. But I don't think Thomas Bjorn was for the Europeans last year. Obviously, you know, you don't think of Davis Love as being a rah-rah guy either, and he's won one, lost one. It's not a football game where coach screaming at the guys. It's definitely not like that, especially once they're playing. You know, you're not seeing captains screaming at guys in the middle of matches. That would be the last thing they would do. So it's definitely not a requisite for this position.
All right. Steve Stricker, the 29th U.S. captain, will be played in his home state of Wisconsin next year at Whistling Straits, and we'll see what happens. But they're in Mexico now, so some of these drives may be going out 400 yards in that altitude, right?
Right? Correct. Yeah, it's the third year playing down in Mexico with the WGC championship, and you see, you know, basically what you think the guys hit driver, that's what they hit the three wood down there, and so the driver is going to be amped up another notch. You might not see them hit as many drivers because of that, because you don't really need to. But, yeah, it's an interesting event. We'll see how it goes. Phil Mickelson obviously won here last year. He put on a show the year before when he came close. So it's a fun event. It's a new event, and obviously it's a World Golf Championship, so you got a great field.
Well, I mean, golf is great. I love it. And we actually had some controversy with Matt Cheapsteak Kuchar. How about that?
Yeah, that's been a tough one. Obviously, you know, the rumors kind of came out on Twitter. A fellow PGA Tour pro started them, Tom Gillis. They turned out to be true. Then Matt Kuchar had a chance to apologize. He didn't apologize. And 2 days later, he did apologize, said he paid the guy what he wanted. You know, it's an unfortunate situation. I think Matt did think he didn't do anything wrong, but obviously when you see the public sentiment go against you, you would think that you would try to overcorrect and do the right thing, and unfortunately it took him a couple days extra to do that. But any apology is better than no apology, and hopefully this guy, David Ortiz, a.k.a. El Tucan, got – you know, a good amount. What is definitely deserved more than $5,000 when you help a guy win $1.3 million. Hopefully that money got wired or, you know, whatever down to his account, and he's having a, you know, a celebratory dinner or so finally.
How does that work? If you win, they get 10%. If you don't, how does that work? What's the caddy rate?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the thing with all these things. There's no official structure, but typically a caddy gets some expenses paid or maybe a small weekly kind of, base pay. And then if you make the cut 5% of the earnings, if you make a top 10, 7%, and then a win 10%. So, you know, the money with the money being so high as it is now, some of these caddies, if you pick the right player.
Holy cow.
I mean, you are raking it in, and we've even seen now in the FedEx Cup era, some of these guys, I know Billy Horschel, for instance, gave a 10% cut of the $10 million bonus to his caddy as well. So that's $1 million bonus for a caddy.
Sweet.
Yeah, so it can, you know, again, if you pick the right horse, you're making some good money.
Who was Tiger's caddy when he just couldn't lose?
Steve Williams.
I'd love to see his bank account.
Exactly. Well, you know, supposedly Tiger had a salary deal with him, and he was making like $1 million a year or something. So he was getting covered. And I think anytime Tiger won a car or anything like that, he would kind of kick it his way as well.
Wow.
So, yeah, he was definitely doing pretty well. But, you know, this situation was obviously totally different. It was a local caddy at the club in Mexico. Matt Kuchar's caddy wasn't there.
Right.
And so that's where there's a gray area, because this other typical structure exists for a regular caddy who's on the road all the year and, you know, shows loyalty to you, and you kind of give them, you know, so even this caddy didn't expect to get the 10%. I mean, but he wanted $50,000, which would have been like, I don't know, 3%. He got less than 1%. So, you know, hopefully he ends up getting what he wanted at least.
Alex, you're the best. Love talking with you. Thanks for the info on the Ryder Cup. Steve Stricker, we'll talk to you soon, my friend. Thank you.
You got it, Jordy. Thanks for having me on, man. Take care.
Alex Myers, Golf Digest. We'll be back. This is the Jordy Helfrich Show.
The Blonde Bomber is back and better than ever as you are locked into the Jordy Hultberg Show on 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com, and on the app.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Don't forget, tonight, LSU basketball, 5:30 pregame show, 6 o'clock tip. They're all big. Here's another big one, trying to keep pace with Tennessee. A win tonight would put LSU at 12-1, tied atop the SEC with the Volunteers, setting up a super showdown Saturday at 11 a.m. That means the pregame show would be at 10:30. That would cut the producers a little bit short on Saturday. But what a ball game it would be with the tip at 11. And all of these games right here on 103.7 The Game. You got baseball. It's a busy, busy weekend on the LSU Sports Network and here at 103.7 The Game. All right, let's go to our daily history lesson because we do it every day at this time of day. We go back to February the 20th, the year 1997. We just saw Manny Machado sign a 10-year, $300 million contract. Back in 1997, San Francisco Giant Barry Bonds signed a then-record 2-year contract for $22.9 million. 2-year contract, $22.9 million. Television rights go up, contracts go up, plain and simple. Plain and simple. All right. Birthday wishes. If today, February 20th, is your birthday, happy birthday from all of us at 103.7 The Game. We hope you have a spectacular, spectacular day. You share with the likes of former LSU golf coach Buddy Alexander. A former Penn State quarterback that came over to LSU, Rob Bolden, never really panned out, but he's celebrating a birthday. And happy 56th birthday to the Chuckster, the round mound of rebound, Charles Barkley, 56 years young today. How about that? How about that? How about that? All right. If it's your anniversary, happy anniversary from all of us to all of you. Special thanks to our loaded guest list today, John Brady, previewing LSU Florida hoops, Michael Huguenin for Hump Day with Huguenin, Brody Miller, NOLA.com with his latest on the LSU baseball Tigers, and Alex Myers for the latest on Steve Stricker being named the Ryder Cup captain for Team USA. Come on back tomorrow, same time, 2 to 4. We'll recap LSU and Florida. We'll take a look ahead, and anything else that's happening in the world of sports, we'll try and bring it to you as best we can. CD, outstanding job as always. Thanks to all of you for listening in, and thanks to our partners that make it possible each and every day. We've only got one Wednesday, February 20th. Have a great one. Come on back tomorrow, same time, 2 to 4, same great station, 103.7 The Game. Until then, I'm Jordy Hultberg. Boot up! Stay thirsty, my friends.
Live from the 237 Roof Studios.